Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. I'm Ed Lentz. Ann is away today. On June 25, 1876, George Armstrong Custer and a good portion of his 7th Cavalry was annihilated on a hillside in Montana near a river called the Little Bighorn. It came to be called Custer's Last Stand and was not the news President Grant and many other Americans had been hoping to hear. Custer's defeat became the stuff of legend, along with other such enduring events as the Alamo, where dashing heroes face overwhelming odds and die fighting for what they believe in. Like many such stories, the Battle of the Little Bighorn became something a little bit different in legend than it had been in reality. But it's still a pretty good story. It's a story of how the West actually came to be won and what it took to win it. And it did bring into close conflict some of the most remarkable people of their time. That story is the subject of a new book, and we're privileged to have its author with us today. The Last Stand, Custer, Sitting Bull, and the Battle of the Little Bighorn is by Nathaniel Filbert, and it's a book well worth reading, and not simply because Custer and a number of his men happen to come from Ohio. Originally from Pittsburgh, Mr. Filbert has lived for a number of years in the East. He's written extensively about sailing and the sea. His 2000 book, In the Heart of the Sea, won the National Book Award for Nonfiction. And his recent 2007 book, Mayflower, has won the Massachusetts Book Award for Nonfiction. He's currently at work on a book about Boston in the early years of the Revolution. Nathaniel Filbert, welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher.
It's great to be here.
After we've talked a bit, we're going to be happy to take your calls as well at 614-292-8513 and emails at allsides@wosu.org. Now, many of your books have been about the sea and sailing and people who live on or near it. How'd you end up on a lonely hillside in Montana in 1876?
Well, you know, I first really became acquainted with this story in high school in Pittsburgh when I saw Little Big Man and with Dustin Hoffman, and that movie just had a huge impact on me. And it was really not till 2006 when I was finishing up Mayflower that I began to think about writing a book on the topic. In Mayflower, my take on that iconic event and how America began doesn't end with the first Thanksgiving. I felt that the story of the Pilgrims and that voyage really had to be taken to the second generation in a war a lot of Americans have never known about, the King Philip's War, fought 55 years after the arrival of the Mayflower. This was just a terrible conflagration between the English and Native Americans of New England. And after that, I said, well, if this is my take on the iconic beginning, where does this process lead? Well, it leads west, and if there's an endpoint to this in an iconic way, I felt it was the Little Bighorn. So that's why I decided to tackle this topic.
Okay, you mentioned pretty early on in the book that it probably wasn't such a great distance of a jump from the sea because the prairie itself's like a sea. What is the role of the big sky country in your book? I get the impression sometimes reading it that weather and terrain and sky are almost becoming characters in the book along the way.
Absolutely. And you know, and what I quickly found the more I got into this topic was that instead of this book being a departure for me, who is really associated with books about the sea, it felt much more like a culmination. One of the arguments in my previous books has been that, you know, we Americans associate ourselves with a wilderness, with the frontier, and it's usually the West, the cowboys and Indians that we look to as that kind of defining element to our nature. But before that, there was the sea, and that was the predominant wilderness when it came right through the first half of the 19th century. And so with this book, what I found was instead of I spent a lot of time out there, what I found was instead of this being different from the oceanic expanses I had come to know with my other book, it was very much of the same piece. You know, the continuities I found fascinating and extremely suggestive when it came to, you know, what America is all about, whether it's the sea or the wilderness of its interior.
Let's talk about research a little bit. I think some of our listeners are always interested as how do you go about doing a project like this? How do you go about researching a book like this? And what are some of the interesting new things that you discovered in passing when you were out there
This is a topic about which a lot has already been written. Some have said more has been written about the Battle of Little Bighorn than any other battle fought on American soil. So there was a tremendous amount of material to get my arms around. But what really surprised me was the extent to which seeing was a part of my research process, not only going to the battlefield and walking it, and at one point even riding a horse over it, but looking at the native pictographs that were drawn after the battle, describing specific scenes, and then following Custer's trail from Fort Lincoln, which is near Bismarck in North Dakota, more than 300 miles west into south central Montana, where the battle was fought. And so the research of this book had sort of many more facets than I was used to, as far as it wasn't just the archival research. There was also talking with descendants of warriors and soldiers who had been in the battle. And one of the surprising bits of evidence that I found was there was a journal written, a narrative written almost 40 years after the battle by Private Peter Thompson, who was 22 years old in the battle. And he should have been killed with Custer, but luckily for him, his horse gave out. And he followed Custer on foot and claimed to have seen Custer just a half hour before his final last stand, and this struck many people as impossible, and his account was very controversial, but I was given access to an unpublished account written by his daughter, in which she describes the process by which he wrote it, and it reveals that he was not basing it on memories 40 years after the battle, but he had kept a notebook and recorded his impressions soon after the battle. So these kinds of evidence all came together, and I tried to tell the story as best I could.
I'm sure many of our listeners probably have not been to that battlefield site, and you undoubtedly have spent a good bit of time there. One of the kind of questions that always comes up, I suppose, is that the world is getting smaller and smaller. I sometimes think if you were trying to retrack the race to the South Pole, you might get there and find a fast food restaurant waiting for you. Right. How much can you still get a sense of what that battlefield looked like that day by being there? Is Montana, that portion of Montana, still pretty well undeveloped?
It is, and that was really a surprising element to this whole thing. You know, with Mayflower, if I went to a historic site, there was a Dunkin' Donuts across the street, and it destroyed the sense of the past. But out there in Montana, the population is so low that when you're on the battlefield, it's a stunning landscape. It's you're on a hill, long hillside, about 6 miles long, overlooking a wide valley. And I've been there now 5 times, and every time I'm there, it hits me afresh. It just packs in a tremendous emotional wallop. And it looks pretty much the way it did then. There are obviously roads where there weren't. There are gravestones where the soldiers and some of the warriors fell. So that obviously is different. But the impression you get looking out over this river valley is amazing, and it's a haunted landscape, and I would urge anyone who has ever thought about going out there to go because it's very different from a Civil War battlefield. It's more than 6 miles in length, and just evokes all the big sky emptiness of the West, but with a deeply spiritual and troubling haunted element to it.
In many ways, your book seems to be something of a parallel biography of both George Armstrong Custer on the one hand and Sitting Bull on the other. Can you tell us just a little bit about what impresses you most about these two men? And we can start with either one you like and then talk about the other a little bit.
Sure. Let's start with Custer. I mean, Custer is known to us as history's biggest loser for what happened at the Little Bighorn, but the fact of the matter is, during the Civil War, he was one of the Union's greatest cavalry officers, and he finished last in his class at West Point, and then went off to the Civil War and was sort of the Forrest Gump of the Eastern Theater of the War. If there was a battle, he was there. And within 2 years of his graduation from West Point, he was a brigadier general. He would be a major general by the end of the war. And Sheridan was so impressed by his accomplishments that he presented the table upon which the treaty at Appomattox had been signed to Custer's wife, Libby, saying that no officer deserves this more than your gallant husband. But when he went west, things changed. The good war of the Civil War was not what was happening out west, when a battle typically required you to attack a village of largely non-combatants. And so Custer changed his image from the boy general to what's been called the cavalier in buckskin. And he had a swashbuckling element to him, and he played the press beautifully. Helping him in this was his wife, Libby, who was really the spin doctor like no other. And he did everything he could to become an American hero. And now Sitting Bull, on the other hand, was much more than a great warrior. And he was a great warrior in his day, but by 1876, he was in his mid-40s. Beginning to age out as an active warrior. And he had a great spiritual side to him, charismatic. He was also very politically savvy. And as the challenges to his people mounted, he became emerged as the leader. And it was his ability to bring the disparate groups of his own tribe together that really made the victory at the Little Bighorn possible.
These two men, let's try to get into mind's eye a little bit. If I was meeting Custer today for the first time, what would be my impression of him? I mean, what sort of fellow is he?
Yeah. Well, let's say he walks into the room, and he was a lightning rod, and you either loved him or you hated him. Half the people in the room would say, "Wow, look at this charismatic leader of men, isn't he something?" And the other half would say, "Look at this egomaniacal blowhard." And, you know, something like Patton or MacArthur, these were officers who, you know, had a real sense of themselves as historic, almost idiosyncratic and anachronistic characters. And this was Custer. And so that, you know, he inspired great loyalty. But he also inspired some real hatred within his own regiment. His second in command, Major Marcus Reno, and his senior captain, Frederick Benteen, were not fans. And I think it was fascinating to track how that animosity worked its way through the regiment in the days and during the actual battle. And I think you can argue that the actual outcome of the battle had a lot to do with this backbiting within the regiment.
Okay. We're going to take a brief break for about a minute or so. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher. I'm Ed Lentz. Ann is away today. And we're going to come back and talk more with Nathaniel Philbrick about his new book about Custer, Sitting Bull, and The Last Stand. We'll be back in a minute or so.
This is WOSU 820 NPR News. See a new lineup of public affairs programming Friday nights on WOSU TV. Starting at 8 is Washington Week, followed by Columbus on the Record at 8:30. Continuing at 9 is the McLaughlin Group, and at 9:30, PBS presents Need to Know, a new program with an innovative broadcast and web approach to news gathering and reporting. Watch the new public affairs lineup every Friday night, beginning at 8 on WOSU TV. And tune in tonight at 8 right here on WOSU 820 NPR News. It's an NPR News special coverage of President Obama's address to the nation. As oil continues to gush into the Gulf of Mexico, Mr. Obama is expected to announce plans that would require BP to put billions of dollars into an escrow account to compensate victims of the disaster. Join us for a live NPR News special. That's President Obama's address to the nation tonight at 8. On WOSU 820 NPR News. And All Sides continues right here on WOSU.
We're back. I'm Ed Lentz. We're talking today with Nathaniel Philbrick about his new book about the Battle of the Little Bighorn and the principles involved with it. just when we were getting around to talking about Sitting Bull. Before we do, let's just listen to a short cut from the PBS documentary The National Parks, America's Best Idea by Ken Burns. A man named Gerard Baker, who was a park superintendent of the Little Bighorn Battlefield, explains what sacredness means to American Indians.
Sacred means different things to different people, and to the American Indians, sacredness means you can go in there and walk as our ancestors did. You can go in there, you can see what the Creator has made for us, and you can feel it, you can feel the spirits. But we can take it one step farther. Because the environment is still there, as in the time of creation, we believe that it is still alive.
Okay. Nat, we had talked a little bit about meeting George Armstrong Custer if he had walked through the door. What would it have been like if we had met Sitting Bull and he decided to come up and pay us a visit?
Yeah, well, you know, Gerard Baker was saying, the sacredness, the spirituality of Sitting Bull, I think, was an overwhelming presence for anyone who knew him. And, you know, he was charismatic, but, you know, there was also an element where he was quite cagey when it came after the battle, and he went into exile in Canada and then would later surrender to authorities and end up in the Standing Rock Sioux Agency. But he was very good at manipulating the media in his own way. Several interviews after the battle did much to create his reputation as one of the more famous people in America. He would go on two national tours, one with Buffalo Bill's Wild West show, and he seems to have used that as an opportunity almost to take a reconnaissance mission when it came to seeing what his people were up against when it came to the white civilization. And, you know, he was someone who inspired great loyalty, particularly around the time of the battle, but like Custer, would have problems later in life on the reservation when the superintendent at the reservation was doing everything he could to undercut Sitting Bull's power within the tribe. And so I think there were similarities between the two men, really, when it came to the last chapters in their lives, where they had to deal with a lot of extraordinary challenges. And and I call this book The Last Stand because I think you can't begin to understand Custer's last stand without putting it into the context of what happened to the Lakota and Cheyenne, because even though they won a great battle at the Little Bighorn, it was really the beginning of their own last stand. And Sitting Bull, 14 years after the Little Bighorn, would his arrest would be ordered by the superintendent of the Standing Rock Sioux Agency, and the Lakota police who came to his cabin would end up firing shots. It's not unclear as to who shot first, but Sitting Bull and several of his family members would die, and so he too would suffer his own last stand. And I think it's important that the battle be seen in the context of both last stands.
Well, you mentioned family along the way, and I think this is one of the nice things about the book, too, that it points out in passing. We often take a look just at the individual. You mentioned Libby Custer along the way, but, of course, Custer, on the one hand, has much of his extended family living with him, and Sitting Bull as well.
Has a family that
you bring into the story. So
yeah, this is really a family story in many ways, and tragically so. Five Custer family members would die at the Little Bighorn. His brother Tom was a captain and an aide de camp to Custer. His younger brother Boston Custer was also there. One of his lieutenants, Calhoun, was married to his sister Maggie. And then there was the 18-year-old nephew, Audie Reed, all of whom would die at the Little Bighorn. And so, you know, this really was a family story. And Sitting Bull was also surrounded by his family at the battle and then 14 years later when he died at Standing Rock. And I think there is a personal dimension to this story that makes it all the more poignant. These were iconic figures, but they were also human beings. and who had responsibilities to their families. And ultimately, this story is a great tragedy.
Well, as I read it too, you're suggesting that it's a story of two clashing cultures. Mm-hmm. How did the clash come about?
Well, you know, this specific battle really began 2 years before with what was known as the Black Hills Expedition, and it was led by Custer, and this was in 1874, and the supposed aim of the expedition was to locate a possible site to build a fort in the Black Hills, even though the Black Hills were legally Lakota land, their holiest of holies. And Custer happened to bring along two gold miners. And sure enough, during the expedition, gold was discovered. And this was just a year after the country had suffered a tremendous economic crisis, the Panic of 1873. And as had been discovered before in California and the Rockies, there was nothing like the discovery of gold to get the economy back on track. And within months, the Black Hills were flooded with more than 10,000 miners. The town of Deadwood would spring up overnight, and suddenly the Grant administration had a problem. Do they use the military to get the miners out, because this was still legally Lakota land, or do they use the military to convince the Lakota to sell the hills? Because in the fall of 1875, they refused to sell, and so this battle at Little Bighorn was part of a campaign to get ownership of the Black Hills, because gold had been discovered there. And so, I think a lot of us tend to think of the wars of the Old West as the military defending innocent pioneers, but this was not the case in this particular campaign. This was an attempt to wrest what was legally Lakota land from the Lakota.
And there weren't really all that many soldiers out there compared to everybody else, were there?
Yeah, I mean, by this point, with this end of the Civil War, the military had been drastically reduced in size. And instead of an army, they were really functioning more as a police force across the vastness of the West. And so it meant that, you know, there were great periods of boredom and frustration, punctuated by moments of terror and battles, and so that it was a very difficult demands were placed upon the military, and officers did not like it. You have plenty of accounts of saying, you know, compared to the Civil War, when war was hot, red hot, said Frederick Benteen at one point, these Indian wars were morally ambiguous. You couldn't feel good about this kind of conflict, but it was what the military were being asked to do.
This is All Sides with Ann Fisher. I'm Ed Lentz. We're talking today with Nathaniel Philbrick about his new book, The Last Stand. And if you have a question about the Indian Wars, about George Armstrong Custer, Sitting Bull, those sorts of things, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or send us an email at allsides@wosu.org. You know, one of the enduring witticisms about Custer has him standing on a hill and simply saying, "Where did all those Indians come from?" Where did they come from? It's not common to have several thousand Native Americans camped in one place, and just the food and water problems, I suppose, would be rather immense. Why were so many Native Americans gathered at that one spot along the Little Bighorn?
Yeah, it was really an extraordinary circumstance, and what led to it was that after Lakota refused to sell the Black Hills, the Grant administration said that all Sitting Bull and all the Lakota and Cheyenne had to come into the reservation, and if they didn't, they would be declared hostiles. And Sitting Bull's response was to call out to the Lakota on the reservations and say, you know, who were all filled with outrage over the attempted sale of the Black Hills, that, you know, come on out. The buffalo are still good, and we'll have strength in numbers. And so, in the the spring of 1876, thousands upon thousands of Lakota and Cheyenne headed west from the reservations and headed towards Sitting Bull's emerging village along the Rosebud River. And in just a week before the Battle of Little Bighorn, what was had already been a huge village of 4,000 Lakota and Cheyenne doubled in size to 8,000. And 2,000 of those warriors, and Sitting Bull said, you know, if the larger we get, the more safety we'll have in numbers, and no one will dare attack us. And of course, Custer decided to attack, and we know what happened after that.
We have a call coming in. Max, do you have a question or comment for us today?
Yeah. Good morning, gentlemen. Excellent program. Ed, you're probably better qualified to speak on this than I am, but I wanted to bring up St. Clair's defeat and comparing that to Custer's defeat, and how St. Clair's defeat was followed by Anthony Wayne's campaign of retribution, and how Custer's defeat was followed by the Wounded Knee massacre, which involved members of the 7th Cavalry.
Well, that's certainly an issue, because this defeat of General Arthur St. Clair in 1791 near what is now Fort Recovery, Ohio, was, of course, a massive setback to the American coming into the Ohio country at that point in time. Nat, do you have any thoughts on how the two compare one with another?
Yeah, well, I mean, one of the particularly when it comes to the Little Bighorn, and I think this tends to hold true, and Sitting Bull was well aware of this, is that when you, in the case of the Lakota and Cheyenne, when you have a great victory, if it's too overwhelming, all it will do is inspire revenge, and that's exactly what happened in 1876 when America learned that one of the country's greatest Indian fighters had been wiped out to a man. The call went out to redouble the efforts, and Congress passed legislation for funding of the Indian wars that never would have gone through beforehand, and forts were built on what had been previously Lakota land, and within a year and a half, just about all the tribal members and their people were on the reservations, and so this great victory was really the beginning of their own last stand. And the caller makes a very good point about Wounded Knee, because Sitting Bull died on the Standing Rock Agency in December of 1890, and just a few weeks after that, several of his followers had fled more than 200 miles south in the vicinity of the Pine Ridge Agency, where the 7th Cavalry had accepted the surrender of a group of Lakota who included these refugees from Sitting Bull, and it's just one of these eerie and terrible symmetries that, you know, here it was Custer's old regiment was in possession of this Indian village, and the warriors were asked, you know, who was there at Little Bighorn, and in that morning when they were attempting to take the weapons from the warriors, shots were fired, and the massacre at Wounded Knee occurred, and you know, this is the terrible aftermath of the battle, and you know, this is, you know, the end point of what began 14 years earlier at the Little Bighorn.
Thanks, Max, for the call. We have another call coming in from Tess. Tess, do you have a comment for us about the Custer site?
Yes. I, on two different occasions, one time I and my husband were out in the national park there in Montana, and it's the Teddy Roosevelt Badlands, or not Badlands, but the Black Hills National Forest. And we took a camp trip, which I assume you're still able to do. We did it on the spur of the moment, but it was arranged to the park office there, which was an overnight pack trip with a wrangler. And they took us to a clearing. It was a full-day ride to get there, where they had some army tents set up, and you spent the night there. And this was where Custer camped 3 days prior to the battle. And So eventually it has changed, and it's still very isolated, and you ride your horses in there, and you really get the a feel for how isolated they were. We don't understand, I think, today how isolated they were, how far away from anything they thought of as, you know, civilization. It's a very moving experience to be there and think of those men camped there. And the second thing is that I was driving from Billings to Sheridan, and I was out there on another trip and happened to have to take somebody to the airport in Billings and was going back to a place I was staying, a ranch in near Sheridan. And it was in September, and it was a rainy day, and I stopped there, and it was virtually empty, being it's no longer summer. And I have to say that's one of the most moving places. It's similar to visiting Antietam, you know, only mm-hmm. not as many people died there, but the feeling of the place is very intense. It was a very, very intense feeling place. But equally intense was that trip. So if anybody's really interested, if they're not so interested and they don't mind riding all day and it's kind of rough riding, you're going to be sore. But that is quite an experience worth taking.
Well, thanks. Thanks for your comment.
That's all I had to say.
Thanks for your comments, Tess. Okay. We had an email come in as well. I think we may have talked a little bit about this, but let's sort of go over the point once again. Email from Ruth. Was Custer really a good general, or was he just a flamboyant military figure? Custer was famous for Custer's luck. I guess the real question is, was he lucky, or was he just very good at what he did?
You know, I think the answer that is the eternal question, but I think it's a little bit of both. He relied on what he called Custer luck. No matter, he could get himself into a very tight spot, but he always seemed to get out of it. And the fact of the matter is, during the Civil War, he would always lead the charge. He had an incredible peripheral vision, and since he was always leading, he could pounce on any weakness in the enemy, and he was just very good on the field. And the wars of the West were different in that the mobility of the Lakota and Cheyenne meant that if you used normal reconnaissance and were seen, they could flee in what seemed the blink of an eye. And so, Custer has always said, well, why, you know, here was a village of 8,000. Well, why did he, with just 650 soldiers, dare attack it? And the problem is that given the terrain of the West, and terrain is really a huge part of this story, it's very difficult to see what you're up against. At dawn of June 25, Custer's scouts could see evidence of a big village in the Little Bighorn Valley, but they could see the smoke and the evidence of a huge pony herd, but they couldn't see the teepees. Mm-hmm. And it wouldn't be until Custer was right on, you know, within a mile of the village, up on a bluff, that he finally saw, my gosh, this is not a village that is fragmenting before my eyes, which was his fear, as was the fear of all military officers. This is a village standing there.
Okay.
And so that, you know, Custer, you can say, is the victim of circumstance to a certain extent, but the fact of the matter also was that, you know, he was flamboyant and reckless, and that often worked for his advantage. And
we have to take a quick break, and
sure,
we'll come back in a minute and pick up on this. We've gotten Custer right there to the battlefield, and we'll come back and talk about a little more about what happens next. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher. I'm Ed Lentz, and we'll be back in a minute or two.
Newsweek correspondent Mazyar Bahari was arrested in Iran 1 year ago while covering the protests. The evidence against him included this clip from The Daily Show.
We headed to a coffee shop off Azadi Square for a clandestine meeting with Iranian journalist Mazyar Bahari. Why was his country so terrifying?
Mazyar Bahari on the next Fresh Air.
And Fresh Air begins in 20 minutes. It starts at noon right here on WOSU 820, NPR News. Developed by WOSU Public Media and the Columbus Metropolitan Library, ColumbusNeighborhoods.org features more than 30 neighborhoods in and around Columbus. It allows users to tell their stories, post their own photos and video, and contribute to the collaborative story of Columbus. To be a part of this multimedia public engagement project or to learn more, visit ColumbusNeighborhoods.org. 79 degrees in downtown Columbus. There is a flash flood watch in effect for much of central Ohio through Wednesday morning. Some sunshine today, also a few clouds. Rain showers are possible, a high of 85. Rain showers and thunderstorms likely tonight. Some of that rain could be heavy, a low of 70 degrees tonight. Cloudy for Wednesday, a chance of morning rain, and then sunshine in the afternoon, and a humid day for Wednesday, a high of 85. All Sides continues on WOSU 820, NPR News.
We're back. This is Ad Lentz, and we're here on All Sides with Ann Fisher this morning, talking with Nathaniel Philbrick about his new book about the Battle of the Little Bighorn. If you have a question or a thought or a comment, please give us a call, 614-292-8513, or send us an email, allsides@wosu.org. That, when we left off, we had Custer basically at the top of a hill seeing that there is a very large camp down there. Having found those folks, he decided to play an old trick and divide his force to give an impression of greater strength and convince his enemy that he was being attacked by all sides. And, of course, that tactics worked from time to time with Lee at Chancellorsville and Custer on the Washita. Why didn't it work that day in 1876?
Yeah, well, you know, you're right. Custer divided his command, and the hope was to contain this village, but the village was just sitting there, and it didn't work because Sitting Bull and his warriors followed the opposite strategy. Rather than dividing their command, kept everyone together, and this meant that when Sitting Bull's warriors attacked, and Crazy Horse took quite a leadership role when it came to the actual battle, they were able to defeat Custer's battalion, regiment, battalion by battalion. He had ordered Marcus Reno to take one battalion and charge down the river valley into the village. Reno, however, did not charge into the village. He stopped right on its verge, threw out a skirmish line, and it was at this point that the momentum shifted, and the warriors were given enough time to find their ponies. Under the leadership of Crazy Horse, they attacked Reno, who was soon in panicked retreat to a bluff to the south. By this time, Custer had proceeded north, and as Reno and Benteen regrouped to the south, the warriors had the opportunity to then turn their attention to Custer. And Custer was on the other side of the intervening bluff, so Reno and Benteen had no idea what happened to him, but he would, everyone under his command, all 210 soldiers, would be killed, and thus would occur the Custer's infamous last stand.
Okay, we have a call coming in. Ed, do you have a question for Nathaniel Philbrick?
Yeah, I think he kind of partially answered my question right there. Is when I was growing up, it was kind of accepted wisdom that regardless of the fact that Custer split the forces, that Reno just didn't fulfill his part of the job, and a lot of the blame from historians went on Reno. And I was wondering if that was still the case, or does more of it lie with Custer of still making a rash decision to attack a oversized village and also split his forces, almost ensuring that he would be cut off if something went wrong. And I'll take my answer off the air.
Okay, thanks.
Those are the eternal questions. And clearly, by dividing his command, Custer increased his vulnerability. But the fact of the matter, too, is that Reno had been ordered to charge the village. He didn't, and then retreated. And then the other element in this is Captain Frederick Benteen. Custer, after seeing the village, sent a messenger to Benteen with a note that said, "Big village, come quick and bring the ammunition packs." Benteen seems to have done everything but come quick, and when he came across Reno up on the bluff after the retreat, he and Reno sat there for at least an hour as the warriors down in the valley flowed to the north for Custer's portion of the battle. And only begrudgingly would Benteen ultimately head to the north to a hill named Weir Point, Weir Peak, named for the officer that sort of shamed him into taking a peek. And it was there that they probably saw the end of Custer's battle. And they also saw the warriors, having dispatched Custer, begin to flow back towards them to the south. And they would retreat about 3 miles to a area where a siege would take place for two days, and they would ultimately be rescued. But it's clear that both Reno and Benteen did as little as they could when it came to potentially coming to Custer's assistance. And so that was definitely a contributing factor. But you can also ask, well, if they had come to Custer's aid, perhaps everyone would have been wiped out. So,
well, that's the other enduring kind of question that military historians are always asking, is that, you know, could Custer have won that battle?
Yeah, and you know, there's some interesting testimony from Lakota warriors who said that when they realized that Custer was up there in the hills after Reno's initial attack, they were very surprised and were under the impression that maybe we're in trouble here. And so, if Custer had been reinforced by Benteen, would he have been in a position to make the greatest comeback of all time? So an earlier battle, the Washita, he had been able to win that by securing hostages, 50 women and children, and he used them as a human shield to extract his regiment when a large group of warriors threatened to engulf them. And there were a lot of non-combatants to the north in the valley, and it seems clear, given the Cheyenne testimony, that Custer towards the end was trying to secure some hostages, because with them he might have gotten out of this alive, if not with a victory. And so, you know, there's so many what-ifs attached to this battle, and I think that's one of the reasons why we keep coming to this, back to this battle, is there's a mystery hovering over it, and that mystery will cause the battle to be revisited and reinterpreted with every generation.
Well, the other kind of point that you had alluded to a little earlier in our conversation, too, is deals with just the glory side of all of this. For all the depths of this defeat, and you've got to look at the death of 200 men is a pretty deep sort of thing, this was still not the worst catastrophe in American history. I mean, more people died of yellow fever in New Orleans in a given year than died on that battlefield at that point in time. And St. Clair's defeat, where there were about 600 men killed back in 1791, but unless you are a student of such things, most people don't remember those sorts of things. How then do Custer and Sitting Bull get this extraordinary fame that's with us still to this day?
Well, I think a lot of it has to do with the myth of the last stand. You know, long before this battle, that myth had a powerful hold on our emotions and the way we like to think of history. There was the 300 Spartans at Thermopylae, the Alamo. You know, all of these things, and when the facts of history come close to a myth, where the leader leading his small band against a numberless foe, and even though he suffers a great defeat and is killed to a man, he wins the ultimate victory because he will be remembered for all time, and the circumstances of Custer's death were easily seen in those mythic terms, and made hero of Custer, and also made an icon out of Sitting Bull. And I think that, you know, the kind of the irony of this is, if Custer had won this battle, we wouldn't be talking about him today. He would just be another one of those generals that sort of fade through the pages of history. It was because he suffered this dramatic defeat that we talk about him today. And Custer wanted to be remembered for all time. That was an ambition of his from a very early age. And it might be said that through this defeat, he got the victory he wanted, in that we're still talking about him today.
And there's something to be said for having a good publicist, just like Fremont had his wife Jessie, Custer had his wife Libby, who turned out to be a reasonably good author. And then, of course, there's Buffalo Bill Cody.
Exactly. Custer benefited from some great publicists. Libby is extraordinary. She would live into her 90s, not die until the early 1930s, and write three books about her experiences with Custer in the West. And she was the gatekeeper to his reputation. People had to toe the line when it came to her portrayal of her husband as a great American hero. And it wouldn't really be till after her death that the first book to begin to challenge that myth, The Glory Hunter, would emerge. And you know, by the time I saw Little Big Man in 1970, the Custer's reputation had shifted 180 degrees.
And then what was the role of Buffalo Bill Cody? Because he basically promoted not only Custer within his Wild West show, but he also promoted Sitting Bull as well.
Right.
Fit into the story?
Yeah, well, you know, he would end his Wild West show with a reenactment of Custer's Last Stand. And so, you know, this was before movies. And so the Wild West show was the equivalent of its day. And so he would travel from city to city in America and even to Europe, and the myth of the Last Stand would be reenacted on a daily basis. And so with this kind of reinforcement, Custer became a part of the culture. That, you know, even in the bars of America, Budweiser came up with a poster of Custer's Last Stand that was in just about every bar in America. And that iconic image of Custer with long blonde hair, with a buckskin jacket and a saber waving above his head is what was imprinted in many Americans' consciousness.
And then The Last Stand, as you mentioned, basically leads as well eventually to Wounded Knee, with the 7th Cavalry sort of coming back for a second act with all of this as well.
Yeah, and it's almost Shakespearean, really, in how it worked out, and it's a terrible tragedy, and it's something that I think there's something different about America and the West that when it comes to colonialism and imperialism in other parts of the world. You know, there are battles very similar to The Last Stand being fought in Africa and India in the Middle East, but South Central Montana is within our nation, and we live with the ultimate consequences of that battle every day. And I after 4 years of writing and research of this book, I've come to realize that really nothing ended at the Battle of Little Bighorn.
Let's talk a little bit more about it, because this is a good story of people who are at least a little bit larger than life. Mm-hmm. But are there other lessons here, lessons we should take away about who we are as a people as well?
Yeah, well, you know, one of the surprises to me in researching this book was to learn that at the moment of Reno's first attack at Sitting Bull's village, Sitting Bull's response was not to respond with force. He was hopeful at the very, even at this late juncture in the battle, that they might be able to resolve this diplomatically. He took his shield that he had gotten from his father and gave it to his nephew, One Bull, and said, "See if the soldiers want to talk." One Bull went up to Reno's skirmish line, and it quickly became clear that these soldiers did not want to talk, and only then did Sitting Bull order his warriors to attack. And I think, you know, we all know about Custer's Last Stand and the image of you know, going in there with your guns drawn and blazing away and dying to the last man is tremendously attractive to many Americans. But I think it's Sitting Bull's example of instead of responding in that way, trying to negotiate. And when negotiation doesn't work, and there will be plenty of times when negotiation isn't an option, only then responding with force. And I think, you know, given where we are in the world today, the Sitting Bull example is perhaps more instructive than the Custer wild and reckless example.
And And they aren't really alone in that Sitting Bull and Custer are two remarkable men in a remarkable time. But maybe there's something about the West in general. They certainly weren't the only figures. I mean, you've mentioned along the way Crazy Horse and others on the Sioux, and there certainly are other cavalry commanders who are acquiring a certain amount of fame in their own right through this period. And it maybe has something to do with where we started talking at the start of this hour about something about the West and that terrain that produces interesting people with interesting stories along the way.
Yeah, well, you know, I think you're right. I mean, it's the isolation of the West, and it's very sea-like. It creates small communities under enormous stress, whether it's 650 soldiers or an itinerant Lakota Cheyenne village. They're really voyaging across this great, immense wilderness, and the tensions and the lack of communication and the isolation all contribute to these situations that bring out the extraordinary in normal human beings.
And we've talked a little bit about Buffalo Bill and Libby and so on, but that's certainly not the end of the story with regard to myth-making, because there has to have been, I haven't done any research on it, but a film about Custer of one kind or another every few years from the time we have motion pictures and television. Do you have any thoughts on just Custer's image today in the American mind?
Yeah, you know, it's interesting. My parents grew up with the Custer of They Died With Their Boots On, Errol Flynn, in 1941, with America just on the cusp of World War II. Errol Flynn is the Custer, the patriot, the brave leader, the kind of leader we need as, you know, entering this terrible conflict. I saw it was a little big man is the Custer, is the wild-eyed, egomaniacal warmonger. And I think it's changing once again in sort of the post 9/11 Iraq Afghanistan war era, when you know, you can, I think we've come to the point where we don't necessarily blame the military for the wars, that, you know, the soldiers are under, we realize that no matter what you think of the war, a soldier's job is to take his orders, and so that I think there's an emerging understanding that the wars of the West were terrible things, but, you know, these were soldiers taking orders, and the Lakota and Cheyenne understood that. There was one warrior after the battle who was asked, you know, what was your understanding of what Custer was trying to accomplish? And he said, well, if you want to understand this battle, you don't look to Custer, you look to Washington, D.C., because that's where the battle really began. And I think that's an understanding that we're sort of returning to in the 21st century.
Okay, we've been talking today with Nathaniel Philbrick about his new book, The Last Stand, Custer, Sitting Bull, and the Battle of the Little Bighorn. I want to thank you very much for taking time with us. It's a great book, and it's been really a privilege to speak with you about it. Thanks so much, Nathaniel.
Well, thank you. It's been a fun hour.
And this has been All Sides with Ann Fisher. I'm Ed Lentz. Ann's been away today. And we're just concluding our discussion of The Last Stand by Nathaniel Philbrick. And this is listener-supported, WOSU and WOSU HD 820, Columbus, and streaming on the web at WOSU.org. WOSU 820, NPR News.
Support for WOSU comes from the estate of Donald R. Glancy, whose life was enriched by public radio and television, and whose bequest seeks to encourage others to discover WOSU public media.